Please keep in mind, the views expressed on the Thin Men podcast reflect those of the hosts and the hosts alone. They are not necessarily representative of the Myrna Loy Center or its staff. Thank you. Welcome to yet another episode of the Thin Men. Thank you for joining us. I am Zach.
I'm Biggs.
And today we have Lenny Eckhart in studio to talk with us. He is an incredibly talented musician, producer. He works in video. He works in sound mixing. He's got a lot of very interesting things to talk to us about.
He's kind of a jack of all trades and soon to be master of a few.
Oh, absolutely. And some would argue he's a master of one or two already.
He won't, though.
No,
he is a very humble, yeah. Sweet, kind-hearted man. We are also going to talk about Jon Stewart's directorial debut, Rosewater. So join us, won't you? Personal friend of myself and the podcast, multi-hyphenate, and we'll have you go through some of those hyphens because the things he does are numerous and varied. Lenny Eckhart, how are you, bud?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, as we said earlier, multi-hyphenate, you do a whole bunch of different things. Now, I know you do live sound mixing. I know you do audio technical stuff. You do production. You do studio mixing. You have your own band and music career.
I do.
Have I missed anything?
And video production.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're like behind and in front of the camera as well as the microphone?
I try to not be in front of the camera.
Okay.
Whenever, if at all possible. But the microphone, yeah, I'm behind the microphone most of the time too. I sing occasionally, but usually I'm behind the scenes with most things.
You're a puppet master.
Yes. I like to think of myself as one of those.
So let's start with the live sound mixing stuff you do and the live tech work you do, because that's how I met you, as you came in. You started working with our former technical director, Alex Wolf, and now with Errol Koch at the Myrna, helping out with a lot of our concerts and live performances. How did you get into that?
I got into that. I wasn't even trying. I had started my own business shortly prior to the time I got on with the Myrna and was kind of struggling to find work and to make ends meet. And Alex had just happened to come into the garage bike shop. My band had played there a couple months prior to this, and I'm friends with Steve down there at the garage. And so Alex went in there for some reason, started talking to those guys for some reason about how they really needed a sound tech guy down at the Myrna. And Steve and my other friend Chad, who worked there at the time, they apparently decided they should recommend me, and gave him my contact info, and that's how I ended up getting the job. I didn't have to do anything.
Well, that's nice.
Quite literally fell in my lap.
Just handed it.
Yeah. So I showed up and ran a show there without much prior training or knowledge of anything at the Myrna.
How much training had you had for that sort of thing in general leading up to it?
I had only been running live sound for a real brief time prior to that. My formal education is in studio production and music technology and that kind of thing, which translates a little bit to the live end of things. But when it comes to a lot of that stuff, I've kind of been self-taught and just learned from experience. And when I had started at the Myrna, I had only been doing it for a pretty short time, actually. I've even learned quite a lot since I started there.
Could have fooled me.
I often feel like, I don't know, kind of an imposter. Because I I feel like I'm not super experienced in this stuff, but people seem to like what I do and like my ear for things, so
I'm happy with it.
Well, I gotta say, that seems to be a mainstay with anybody involved in music whatsoever, is if you really get down to it, everybody feels like a fraud.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it's like, well, I learned to play guitar from this video. Nobody really showed me, so yeah. I don't know how my guitar playing is. I guess people like it. So you said you started out from in-studio recording. Now, was this recording your band, or was this through other ventures as well?
Well, I've been doing the studio thing for about 10 years now, so my current band is a pretty new thing. So,
what's your band's name?
It's called The Boy and Sister Alma. But as far as studio stuff goes, I started going to school for it when I was like 20, so about 10 years ago, and just kind of did home recording stuff, you know, little solo stuff, did some kind of silly electronic songs and released them all under this moniker, you know, I called it Blind Bartimaeus, and it was a lot of school projects, really. It was projects I did for school, and then I decided to release them as tracks, and that was really how I got started recording. And just really did solo stuff for a long time, recorded a random, you know, artist here and there. Didn't really get serious into, like, actually running a recording studio and recording and producing for other bands until maybe 3 or so years ago.
So where did you go to school for sound engineering? Is that what you did, sound engineering?
Music production and technology through Berklee College of Music, which is in Boston.
And it is not prestigious at all. Not at all impressive in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I technically just have a master's certificate. I don't have a degree, so it was a 3-year program.
Oh, man, what a fraud.
Oh, yeah. Man. So
you only went to school for 3 years.
It's all coming out.
This really is a gotcha interview. Uh-huh. So when you're working with other bands and other artists, do you prefer working with like a full band, or do you prefer working with the solo artist who sort of started doing the stuff you were doing when you first dove into music production?
It depends on if the solo artist is doing something that I'm actually interested in. I can enjoy engineering and mixing for a band that kind of knows what they're doing and has their own thing, and I don't have to be too involved as far as making them sound good.
Sure. Okay.
as a band, like trying to help produce their songs into something that's actually decent and that I like, you know, that's more of an issue with a solo artist. Because they're going to be probably oftentimes depending on me more to help with production and instrumentation. And I've done that for a couple solo artists, and it's been fun because there have been people that are very talented and write music that I'm actually interested in. So it's very different working with, you know, a band that already has their songs kind of put together and working with a solo artist that maybe just has, you know, only plays all of their songs on an acoustic guitar and, you know, wants me to help flesh them all out into something of a bigger, fuller arrangement. It's just a different process, and I enjoy both. Mm-hmm. But I probably would not enjoy working with a solo artist who is doing music that I don't care for. I'm kind of picky and snobby in that way. And I kind of pick and choose who I'm interested in working with, you know, because I only have so much time and resources, so I kind of have to be picky.
Sure. So when you said fill out the sound for a solo artist, what does that involve? I mean, does that involve you picking up an instrument, or is it just how you're layering effects? Or
yeah, a lot of times all those things, and depending on what that artist is capable of doing themselves, you know, so I produced an album for a gal last year that was basically, she plays piano and she played some keys on several of the tracks. And other than that, I did all the instrumentation, and it's a pretty fully produced album, lots of instrumentation and production on it. So I did the vast majority of the instrumentation on that. So in cases like that, I'm kind of, I'm doing that. I'm performing a lot of the parts and engineering and mixing and doing a little of all of that.
Let's go back a little bit. I'm going to take a guess that this all started with playing music.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so what was your first experience with playing music?
My mom made me start taking piano lessons when I was 6 years old.
And it stuck.
I guess so, yeah. I hated it for a long time. and she made me keep doing it, and eventually, like, paid me money to practice.
Wow.
So she was very persistent in keeping me studying music, which turned out to be a good thing that I'm very grateful for.
Did your mom play music?
Uh-huh. Yeah, she played piano, and so that's probably why she had me take up piano when I was young. And, yeah, as I got into, like, kind of later teenage years, I started appreciating jazz and some other things, and found some things that I actually enjoyed playing on piano, learned to play some Radiohead songs and things like that, and realized that this could actually be something I could enjoy doing.
Okay, I know with playing an instrument, it's kind of two skill sets, like learning music through sheet music or by ear, mm-hmm. And then actually making your own music. At what point did you start making your own music?
When I was a teenager, and none of it was ever anything very serious, I started writing songs and stuff, you know, just on guitar at a pretty young age. I wasn't in a band or anything until I was like 19 or 20.
How did that come together?
That was just some friend in Billings, some friends of mine who eventually invited me to be in their band. And I said, okay. And then we were a band for a few years and it was really good. That's how that came together.
So when you were writing those early songs on guitar, who were the biggest influence? Who were you ripping off at that point?
Probably like Chris Carrabba from Further Seems Forever and uh-huh. What's that other band?
Dashboard Confessional.
Confessional. Yeah.
We just had a real emo bro moment together.
Yeah. 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 That was when I was like 15. So that was some of the first stuff that I like started trying to like write my own stuff on guitar would have been that kind of thing. Probably
the hard on the sleeve singer-songwriter sort of thing.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I did some like, I was really into like a lot of punk and ska stuff at the time too. So I kind of tried to write some stuff like that, but again, I wasn't in a band. So it was just me kind of sounding like Dashboard Confessional, I guess is okay. What that was.
Okay. And yeah. How about now to contrast to that?
What kind what of music do I do now?
Well, what do you do now and what inspires you the most now, if those are two separate styles?
What inspires me, a lot of what inspires me isn't even music now. I'm inspired a lot by films and, I don't know,
so
experiences.
Tone and aesthetic more than audio style.
A mood and something that conjures, you know, something I see in a movie that, I don't know, conjures up some kind of
imagery.
Emotion and imagery in my brain, and even the sounds of a film, you know, like our very first song that the Boy and Sister Alma released was very much inspired in every way by a movie called Beyond the Black Rainbow. Just the sounds of that movie and the look of that movie and the era that movie apparently took place in, and just the whole vibe of it was very inspiring in a way, and that resulted in that song. So there have been several songs that we've done that have kind of drawn from the same inspiration and music too. It's very, what we do is very kind of 80s pop inspired. So there's definitely some influence there.
Have you ever tried to score a movie?
I've scored some short films and some of my own short video productions. Other than that, I've never done any like real serious film scoring projects. It's something I've always been interested in and would love to do still someday.
But you've done some. How do you begin with that process?
Like what's the process I actually
go
into?
Okay, let's talk about, for example, you said you scored somebody short.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you go about that? I mean, did they hand you the film first and then?
Yeah. They it wasn't even a completed film. It was like a few scenes, and some of it, you know, was just described to me. So it wasn't really your standard kind of film scoring process. And I kind of just came up with stuff based on kind of the moods and the imagery that was described to me and kind of the brief little bits of it that I had seen. So I don't really have any, or I didn't have any real mathematical, scientific way of approaching it.
Did you play in the room to the guy, or did you kind of take a little bit and figure it out and then...
Yeah, I just recorded stuff and sent it to him, and then he actually kind of edited it and edited the music that I sent him and made that fit with the film. And so I've done that in that way working for someone else who's made a film, and I've done it a lot for my own stuff. I've done a few short films, and that was more of kind of a traditional, like, I have this video put together, and then I compose the music to it.
What does the gestation process for a Boy and Sister Alma song look like?
Forever. It takes forever.
Okay, so where do you start at the beginning of Forever? What's the first thing you walk into the room with?
Sometimes I'll just be sitting in front of my computer playing around with different sounds. A lot of it just starts on the computer. You know, I have this software that I use and emulations of different old vintage analog synthesizers, you know, so I have I basically have emulations of, you know, an entire room of analog equipment and instruments. I don't have that in real life, but I have it all on my computer, and it's pretty authentic sounding. So I'll just start on the computer usually, and Jen, my musical counterpart, and I will just sit in the room and, you know, we'll start messing around with something. I'll start playing something, and she'll sit there and try and come up with, you know, additional ideas. She isn't involved so much as an instrumentalist, but she tells me, like, that sounds stupid, or you should make something that sounds like clouds, or she'll say things like that, and she has a really good ear for stuff. So that's kind of the process. That's kind of how we start a lot of things.
Do you write by committee, or do you have somebody who's very much in charge of the material?
Jen and I are both kind of equally, I would say, in charge. I'm more of the technician and the musician, but Jen has a very strong kind of producer role and creative role as far as, you know, helping a song come into fruition. So I think we both take equal ownership and equal responsibility to make things happen.
So is it that just the two of you in the band?
As far as the studio goes, up till now, it's just been the two of us, and we are kind of evolving into a four-piece. We have had that in mind for the live incarnation of the band for a while, and we've done one show so far with the four-piece, and we have a bunch of shows lined up this spring that is going to be that band. I think the idea is that's going to kind of become more of the band in every respect. We want to get those other two guys involved in the studio and the writing process as well.
So what are the four pieces?
We have our friend John, who plays drums, and he plays a combination of acoustic and electronic drums, sample pads, that kind of thing. And our friend Josh, who plays keyboards and synthesizers and sampler things and all kinds of things.
Miscellany.
Yeah, miscellany. And then when we're playing live, I'm usually on guitar and playing a keyboard here and there. And then Jen sings and plays a variety of things as well. She plays bass sometimes. She hits things. She plays some keyboard. She plays some vocoder with her voice. She's very multifaceted as well.
So do you guys just switch to where the song needs it then?
When we're playing live?
Yeah.
We don't switch it up much. We all kind of have our own roles, I guess, even though we're all kind of jumping between multiple things. But yeah, I guess just whatever the song dictates. And it's hard for me to answer that question because we still have a lot to figure out with the four piece. We've only done, you know, a couple weeks of rehearsals and one show with the four piece, and we have some kind of bigger, more elaborate shows coming up this spring. So we still have a lot we need to figure out as far as the technical side of things and how everything's going to be performed.
How do you share the lyric writing load along with the music stuff?
Jen writes almost all of the lyrics, and she tries to make me write some of them, but I don't like writing lyrics, so.
That was the next question.
she ends up having to write most of them and does a much better job than I could, I'm sure.
She does do very good work. I can vouch for that.
Yeah, she does. She comes up with a lot of the vocal parts in general, the melodies and lyrics, and that's mostly her.
Okay, so recitals aside, what was your first live performance that you did?
Ever in my life?
Sure. Let's put it in the band perspective.
Okay. The first live performance with a band or with this band?
With a band.
Okay, with a band. My first real band that I was ever in was when I was like 20 years old. I kind of got a late start, and It was called Ada. We were in Billings. We were a six-piece band with lots of keyboards. And that was probably the first show I ever played with them was probably my first real show with a real band.
So were they all experienced playing shows and you were kind of the newbie? Or
They had had more experience playing in bands before. I had performed, like, you know, all kinds of, like, piano recitals, and I had played in, like, the youth group band at church when I was a teenager and things like that. So it wasn't something that was entirely new to me, like being on a stage playing an instrument, but that would have been the first time playing in that band, and that was a pretty cool, unique experience. That was, I don't know, people seemed to like us. We had a good run with that band, so that was good.
Did you have any nerves going on stage?
I'm sure I did, yeah. It's hard to remember. I used to get, you know, pretty nervous, get some kind of stage fright going on, but never anything that caused me to not be able to perform, I guess. And nowadays, I'm pretty used to it, so it's not really an issue.
So we know, or I know from working with you, and people who've come to the Myrna and seen shows know from seeing your work, that you know what you're doing when it comes to putting a show together in terms of the technical, logistical stuff, getting everything laid out and working with Errol in this case, or Alex as it was, to get set up. How much input do you have in terms of the stage setup for your live shows, and how elaborate do you want to get with that?
I have a lot of input. I'm kind of, I think a lot of it is going to be relying, you know, kind of on me as far as what our live shows look like and how it's all put together. I don't want it to be terribly complicated. Our live set with the four piece is already fairly complex. We have a lot going on. We have a lot of technology on stage and a lot of cables running everywhere. And my ultimate goal is to keep it as streamlined as possible and to still be able to do some really cool things. So one of my goals, which is one of the more feasible ones, is to have big sample pads, basically big things that we hit with sticks. That
that's a way to break it down.
I don't know exactly what they're going to look like, but they're some kind of sample trigger pad things that we can hit, and, you know, like a drum, and it's going to trigger sounds that we have programmed and sampled, you know, to be performed for a certain song, and they light up when you hit them. So it's kind of a cool audio visual kind of effect that would be part of our performance in that way. That's something I'm planning on building. So there are things like that. But yeah, it's hard to say right now. I have a lot of ethereal ideas in my head that may or may not ever happen as far as our live shows go. But we've always wanted them to be kind of this big, flashy, kind of theatrical thing that would be really memorable for people. You know, we've always wanted to be the kind of band that just doesn't play, you know, a normal show just like any other band. We want it to be kind of an overwhelming multi-sensory kind of experience. So that's the goal.
Are you the same person on stage that you are off it?
In the Boy and Sister Alma, we kind of have these little personas that we've created for ourselves, but we don't get that into character.
I don't mean it that way, but I mean, do you act differently when you're on stage?
Probably. I'm sure I do. I don't really think of it too consciously, like I'm going to act this way when I'm on stage, but I'm sure I do. I'm sure I'm more animated when I'm on stage. I'm pretty laid back and monotone, as you've heard, and relaxed in real life. And on stage, I don't know if that's my true self on stage or my fake self. I'd probably try to be a little more of a rock star.
Yeah, it's a little bit of showmanship, right?
A little bit. Nothing that's going to cause the ladies to throw their panties
no
at
me. No Motley Crue business up there?
Yeah, I highly doubt that. Yeah.
By the way, that effect is pretty hard to pull off, I gotta say.
So I want to go back to the sound mixing and the technical stuff.
Yeah.
And this one, I just sort of want you to walk our listeners through this, because a lot of people, anyone who's been to any sort of live concert of any kind, or even just hanging out at a bar or a county fair or anything like that, they've seen the guy at the booth with the soundboard with all the knobs and the buttons.
Yeah.
So for once and for all, can you tell the layperson what exactly it is you're doing up there?
So what's your first step?
the first step is to talk to the band and get an idea of what they've got going on stage. I mean, there are a lot of steps involved, and it's always kind of a whirlwind of activity, you know, getting a band set up and getting a sound check done.
Okay, so walk us through a sound check, for example.
So, I mean, my job involves, you know, kind of a lot of roadie stuff, helping the band get set up on stage, and then getting everything patched in, setting up microphones, doing all of that, and then...
What's the goal when you're setting up a microphone and all the instruments, I mean?
To do it as quickly as possible, and use the right microphone and put it in approximately the right place. If that's at all helpful. I don't know. It kind of all comes with experience. Just, you can do it any number of ways, and there's not necessarily a hard science to it. You know, a lot of it is preference and kind of arbitrary opinion from one sound guy to the next. So everybody does it kind of different, and I kind of have my own way of doing things. But it really, I'm going to put a microphone in front of something that I want to have mic'd, and I'm not going to usually get too picky about, you know, how exactly it's placed or what kind of mic I'm using, unless, 'cause we really don't have a lot to work with a lot of the time anyway. Really what you're trying to do is just to be really efficient and work up a rapport with the band. That's almost more important. That's going to go a lot farther as far as having a successful show is, you know, the sound guy developing a good relationship with the band and good communication with the band. And that's going to help things go smoothly. As far as the technical stuff goes, I mean, that's obviously important and you need to have some knowledge there. But I think in most cases, it's going to go a lot farther to make the show go well if you're just working up a good relationship with the band and have good communication and you aren't pissing each other off, because that's always a possibility.
Once the show is underway and the band's playing and you've got six different instruments or whatever it is and three people singing or whatever it is, what are the things you're listening for up there? What are the red flags you're looking out for? What are the things you're trying to enhance?
I'm always trying to have the kind of experience that I expect or I hope to have when I'm going to a show, because I go to a lot of shows, and I want the music to be big enough and loud enough that you're going to feel it and you're going to be able to get into it without, you know, being deafening. And that's always a very delicate balance at a place like the Myrna, and we have different crowds and, you know, different demographics and different kind of bands, so it really varies a lot. But what I'm really always attempting to do is, you know, have a balance of instruments on stage that's audible and clear, so you can hear everything that's happening up there, having, you know, what you could call a good mix, having vocals be audible and lyrics even be intelligible, which is sometimes difficult, and then have it be big enough and full enough that, you know, you're gonna feel it a little bit, and it's gonna, you know, it's going to give you that kind of experience that I think a lot of people are looking for when they go to a show, which is a little bit of, you know, an emotional full body kind of experience. Sometimes bands make that easy, and sometimes they don't, depending on the kind of music it is and the level of musicians they are.
So I wanted to shift gears a little bit. You said that you produced a short before.
Yeah, I've done a few different little things. A friend of mine, Davey, and I, a few years back, did a little kind of animated short that was all done kind of with cardboard puppets. That was like a 10-minute little animated short called Robotic Love, all about these robots who are in love.
App title. What did you do in the short?
I mean, it told this little adventure kind of story, and we did it all with these backdrops that we built and these cardboard things that we moved around with strings. It was a combination of kind of puppetry and stop motion. We shot things in layers against a green screen, so we would shoot like different layers of the background against a green screen, and then like the puppet characters against a green screen. And then we'd key all the green screen out of all those different layers and composite all those different layers into a scene.
How did you learn to use green screen?
Just over the years from experience. I had to do it for my old job somewhat frequently. I did a lot of video stuff.
What was your old job?
I moved to Helena working as the media arts director for a church. So we shot a lot of stuff on green screen, and that's kind of how I learned to do it.
So just by doing it?
Yeah, just by doing it. I'm really self-taught with video stuff. I kind of do it as a profession now. It's more my full-time job than anything else is.
How was the green screen introduced to you? Was it something you thought was a good idea? Somebody else?
Yeah. It's something I wanted to do. I like the idea of it. I like the possibilities that you have.
What were you making for a church that required green screen?
basically like 300 sequels.
Interesting. You have my attention.
With much more sex, because I didn't think the original 300 had enough sex. No.
Okay. What church were you doing?
I'm lying. It was like the announcements, like, you know, churches do announcements.
Sure.
So we did announcements on video, and I wanted to do them like a little mini news broadcast, but like something very kind of tongue in cheek and silly. So yeah, we shot them all on green screen and kind of did it like a little, you know, we had a couple of our news anchors, you know, sitting there, and we shot them against a green screen, and they did the announcements mixed with other just kind of ridiculous, silly banter and spoofs and goofs and stuff like that. So that's
fun.
What it was. Yeah.
Okay. Right, now cool. I gotta know. Step one: a green screen here. How did you learn this?
The internet's so amazing.
What?
Yeah.
I mean, was this just like a YouTube dive or?
Yeah, I guess so. There are a few different resources online. I mean, really, on YouTube, there are lots of, like, you know, basically you can get a whole film school worth of education practically on YouTube. There's some great resources. So it was pretty much all from that. I just learned stuff online.
So you tell your boss, yeah, I'm going to do this green screen thing. And he's like, yeah, okay, do it.
Yeah.
And then you're like, yeah, I got to figure this out.
Yeah.
That's great, man. Yeah. I mean, that's
how it went, pretty much.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's good that you have the wherewithal to figure all those things out. I mean,
yeah, well, I'm kind of, ongoing learner, I guess. I really like learning new skills and challenging myself to get better at what I'm doing. You know, I'm never exactly content with anything I'm doing or the level of skill that I'm at in anything. So I'm always just seeking new knowledge, and I'm just online all the time, you know, trying to learn these things. So
where do you think that comes from? I mean,
I don't know. I think it's probably something everybody is maybe inclined to do in one way or another. It's just a matter of, like, if you're spending your time and your work doing what you really enjoy doing, and that's what I've gradually been able to do. I think it just comes from that, from doing the kind of work that I love to do kind of on a full-time basis and wanting to be the best at it. And I'm never going to be the best at it, but I'm always kind of striving for that goal. And so I'm just studying those things, you know. I'm not like the kind of guy who wants to learn about anything and everything. I'm pretty specific with, you know, the stuff that I'm looking up and trying to learn. So, and it all revolves around what I do for a living and what I enjoy doing, music and video and that kind of thing, you know.
All righty, so I think this is the last one from my mic. For people who want to get to know the work of Lenny, what is your proudest accomplishment in producing, and what is your proudest accomplishment musically that people can find and check out?
In producing music?
Either. Music, video.
As far as video, I just made a music video for my band, so it all kind of ties together. It's the first music video I've ever made, and I'm pretty happy with it. So our music video for our song Lady Killer by The Boy and Sister Alma. That's my most recent big video project that I've done. So I feel like that's kind of a culmination of all the skills that I've learned to date, is that music video. That's kind of what I set out to do with that video. That would be, you know, where I would direct people as far as that goes.
And is that up online now?
Yeah, it's on YouTube and Vimeo.
We'll be
sure
to throw a link up on Facebook and on the blog.
Oh, thanks.
We're multimedia.
That's cool. Wow, you guys are cool.
You guys can watch it while you listen to it, and then watch it again with the sound. So you get the layered effect. You can see where you use that green screen.
Oh, yeah. I actually didn't use any green screen on that video, but I did some compositing and some other kind of little fancy effect things. Anyway, there's that. And then as far as music goes, I guess my favorite things that I've produced and recorded and mixed have been my own band's material, our EP, and our couple of singles we released prior to the EP. I think our song, Tom's Cruise, is one of my favorite songs, favorite sounding songs I've ever produced and engineered and mixed. I'm really happy with how that song sounds and how it turned out. And then the album that I produced for Sarah Fraser called What the Blind Would See If the Mute Would Speak. And that was one of those kind of situations that I was talking about earlier, where she was a solo artist and I kind of contributed a lot of production and instrumentation to that whole project. And I'm pretty proud of how that turned out, just from kind of the standpoint of being a producer on something, which was really the first time I did that on a full-length album for another artist. So,
where can we find your music online?
The Boyne Sister Alma, you can search for us on Google.
See, you did the smart thing. You chose one of those names that's not going to get mixed up and you have to go to like page 4 to find.
Yeah, the first 3 pages or so of Google will be pretty much all us, because it's no one else. Nothing else is called that. we have a website. We're on Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr and SoundCloud and Bandcamp. You can purchase our music on Bandcamp and on iTunes. You can listen to all of our stuff streaming on Bandcamp and SoundCloud. We're on all those places, on Spotify, all the internet places, most of them anyway. Last.fm, if you want to scrabble us, if you do that kind of thing, if you're a scrabbler.
I don't even know what scrabbling is, but it frightens me.
I don't know if people do it anymore, but it was a thing.
I'm not sure people did it.
Yeah. Well, check it out.
I'm interested. I need to know what this scrabbling is.
You might be into it. You never know until you try.
Do you have anything you want to plug? I mean, like dates or anything like that, beyond just
dates.
Site?
If you're in Helena or in Montana, the Boyne Sister Alma we're kind of going on tour this spring. That wasn't necessarily our intention, but we have a bunch of shows lined up. We're playing in Missoula at Stage 112, I believe, in January. We're going to be playing up in Whitefish, I believe, in February. Playing a couple dates in Helena, playing at the Myrna, possibly. I don't know if that's confirmed, but I think we're playing at the Myrna.
It'll happen.
In March. So we'll be getting around Montana playing shows, so just keep an eye out for us. Hopefully it will be cool.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming, Lenny.
Hey,
it was wonderful to have you.
Thanks, Thin Man. You guys are great. Really appreciate
it. Do we live up to the name?
You do.
We could be part-time models.
So today we are reviewing Rosewater.
Yeah, talking about it, the directorial debut for Jon Stewart, a.k.a. the reason John Oliver has his own show on HBO right now.
Can we talk about that for just a second?
I think briefly we can go into it, yeah.
So they didn't lock up his contract after he hosted The Daily Show.
Mm-mm, which, rookie mistake.
I think they were trying to lowball him for money, Comedy Central was, and now he's got a hit show on HBO as a result. Not smart.
Mm-mm, did not pan out. I'm sure no one is happy. Okay, on the list of people,
I bet Jon Stewart is happy, but I think he likes that people leave The Daily Show and do well.
No. I was going to say, on the list of people who are delighted that Jon Stewart took a leave of absence from The Daily Show to direct this movie, number one is Jon Stewart, number two is Mazyar Bihari, number three is John Oliver. Those, in order, those are the three most delighted people that this movie exists.
Now, one thing that really interested me when I watched this movie was I knew it was a very serious tone. You know, I wasn't expecting any comedy when I went in, but they have a scene where one of the correspondents,
Jason
Jones,
playing himself,
He's interviewing
Mazyar Bihari.
Yes. And I'm watching that and I'm like, I saw this. And then it started to jog my memory. And then I remembered, oh, yeah, because I saw that when they first aired it. And then I saw it when they repeated it later. And Jon Stewart made a point to mention that he was now being detained by the Iranian government. And I'd just forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had no idea that this actually had personal ties to Jon Stewart.
Super personal, which I honestly believe is part of why the movie ended up as good as it did. Is I think there was a moment where, especially when Mazyar Bihari's book came out, where Jon Stewart said to himself, someone is going to make this movie. It's way too fascinating a story to not make it. And there's a real good chance that whoever does is going to screw it up. And I need to make this movie because if someone has to screw it up, better me than somebody else. Like, I think the story was too personal and too important to him to risk someone else telling it.
And the interesting thing about the movie is it's not a funny movie. There's definitely a couple of funny parts,
mm-hmm.
but you really get to see Jon Stewart stretch his wings and do other things.
Absolutely. I mean,
it's political, so it's right up his alley. As anybody who's a Daily Show fan knows, he has his moments where he just goes full-on rage on people.
Mm-hmm.
Not like O'Reilly, but very reason things.
Yeah.
Where
he just had one the other day with one of the guys from Fox and Friends.
Yes. And he's really good at taking their points and breaking them down with it. And this movie very much feels in that vein. So essentially what it's about is this Iranian journalist. He goes back to Iran. He's basically Americanized at this point. I think he goes to college in America. He works for Newsweek. He's got a girlfriend that he got pregnant, or maybe a wife. I think his wife that he gets pregnant. And he goes back to cover the Iranian election. And then, as people may remember, because this is around 2009, the Iranian election was...
It went poorly.
You could imagine that it was fixed. And so he is at a protest, and he winds up filming somebody getting murdered by the Iranian government. And this basically lands him in jail. So they show government officials showing up at his house, and they wind up taking him. And then they show all the things that led up to this decision. We're basically talking the first and second act. And then the third act is just completely him in prison trying to figure out what to do while he's in there, what the right thing to do. He talks with the ghost of his father. I mean, yes. It's not actually a ghost. It's clearly in his head.
Yeah,
and they go out of their way to show that. But he's talking with his father, who was imprisoned by the Iranian government in 1953, who's basically giving him the strength to get through it. And then eventually he winds up going his own way to get out. And I guess if you know the story, none of this is a surprise. I mean, it's an actual story, yeah. So I don't think
you can't have a spoiler alert on a true story.
Right. But he winds up, you know, reading the letter that the Iranian government wants him to read. But then he finds out that people haven't forgotten about him because a couple of people in the prison basically let it slip.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point forward, he's in the driver's seat, which is really entertaining to
watch. Super fascinating.
Yeah, because it's really depressing when you watch it. And I was telling my wife when we walked out of that movie, I've seen a lot of movies with people that are in prison and being broken down by the people on the other side of the table. But usually when they start to torment the attackers, they get beaten as a result. And they do the thing where they laugh it off or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But he is able to laugh it off, and there's no repercussions. And you know that's real because they know they have to let him go, and they know he's a member of the media. So they also know he's going to talk about everything that happened to him. And it's a really interesting story. I mean, it could be a genre movie if you take out the real life aspect to it, but it turns everything on its head. You know, I really recommend this movie. It's an interesting watch.
One of the things that impresses me most about this film is Gael Garcia Bernal. Now, anyone who's listened to this podcast is aware that I enjoy acting and I am very passionate about actors and their art. And Gael Garcia Bernal, he's a Mexican actor, which is interesting. He's one of my favorites. I adore this guy. I will watch anything he does. And he gives a very good performance in the first two acts of the film. He's very charming, very likable. It's very easy to understand why a guy like this would be interesting as the lead of a film.
Mm-hmm.
The final third of the film is a tour de force from his part. the scenes where he's just in captivity, especially towards the end, like the scene you mentioned where he talks to his father, the scene where he finds out he's getting released, are just these such windows of honesty into what it would be like to be a man or woman who's forced to be in captivity for any reason, regardless of the reason. These shockingly true moments, these things you see in his eyes when they finally, when he finally finds out he gets to go home, the look he has when he's sort of conversing with his father, these very human moments that are so impossible to relate to for the average person, especially the average American, and especially the average American who's seeing this movie, who is likely a middle class or more wealthy white American. To be able to take something that's so specific like this and to make it relatable is an astonishing feat, and it deserves more notice than I feel like it's getting.
Well, see, here's what I'd also say about that. It's not as out of reach as you might think. There's a lot of play between him and his wife, and who's pregnant. I mean, anybody's a parent who goes to see this movie is just, you understand that he wants to be there. He's going to have a daughter. Like, he's in love with somebody. Like, I think that's something that even if you don't have a wife
absolutely,
or a kid, you can really rally behind.
Absolutely. And that's sort of why I specified those two moments in particular, is because you're right. Most people can relate to having someone that they pine to see again or something to look forward to. Most people, the average person does not know what it feels like when someone tells you after you've been in captivity for almost half a year or a year or longer or what have you. Most people don't know that feeling when you finally get told you're leaving.
Yeah.
And to be able to portray that in such a way that it feels universal is, I mean, it's bewildering. It's the kind of thing you almost can't intentionally do as an actor. You have to try your best to be honest to yourself and hope it works out that way.
You know, it's funny you say the word hope, too, because that actually brings up a theme that's in this movie. There's a scene which honestly has to be written. I don't think there's any way they could have known that this dialogue happened. But it's between the warden and the interrogator. And he's talking about how you can't leave this guy any hope. Like, you're going to have to break down his mind. Basically, breaking down his body isn't going to work. You're going to have to break down his mind. But if he has any hope, this isn't going to work. And the interesting thing about this movie is that third act, they're just breaking him down and breaking him down. And he has no hope left at a certain point. And then certain things happen that give him hope. And as soon as that hope comes back in, there's this change. Like, there's a change in how he carries
himself.
It's
like a light turns on in his eyes.
And like I said, that's where he starts to kind of mouth off back. And then there's even his father in these visions that he's having is telling him, don't give them anything. Don't give them anything. Don't do what they want you to do. And at that point, he doesn't care. Because he realizes as soon as he gets out of there, you know, he's going to be free to tell the world everything that happened. And that's really interesting to me that these visions that are keeping him strong are ultimately not even the best thing to do. I mean, they hand him a document at one point when he knows he's going to be going. He just signs it like it's no big deal for whatever.
He's like, whatever.
Throws it back to the guy. Like, before the guy can even finish on a spiel of why the guy should sign it, he's already got it signed and handed it back. He knows. He just doesn't want to get beat up by the war, and he just wants to get the hell out of there and
he's like self-preservation
story.
It's like it's like self-preservation. Who really cares at that point?
Yeah, exactly. But it's a really interesting movie. I think it's uplifting. My wife, who is not political at all, really enjoyed that movie too. I mean,
it's surprisingly uplifting.
Yeah, there's something on the base level of watching somebody who's in prison with their rights taken away from them, who can get out of that situation. It's just uplifting to the soul. I mean,
I think
there's no other way to put it.
I think it's because it's the type of concept that speaks to one of our most base fears. And to see anyone overcome those incredibly traumatic fears is inherently inspiring. It's the kind of thing that reminds you what a triumph the human spirit is capable of achieving. It's the sort of thing that can adjust your perspective on life. It can refresh your perspective on life. It's the thing that I love most about the movie is that it is not cynical. It is earnest and sincere every step of the way about a situation that it would be so easy to be cynical and angry about.
Yeah, they could have made the movie where you have a sour feeling in your stomach at the end. A good example would be Midnight Run.
Okay? Yeah, absolutely.
You watch that movie, and this guy gets in prison, although it's different circumstances. You see the horrible things he goes through that nobody should be subjected to. And by the end, you don't feel good necessarily when he gets out. Like, you're happy he gets out, but you still feel awful because you know what's happening, and, mm-hmm. and there's just a sour feeling. But you get the feeling out of watching this movie that things are eventually going to be okay, that human rights is going to win the day eventually. And I like that.
In a political climate where it's overwhelmingly doom and gloom, there's so many things to be angry about, and there's so many things to be justifiably angry about in America and in the world. It's nice to see someone who is angry about the same things as us still find a way to be, if not optimistic, at least find hope within the world they're in, and within the idea that one person can make a difference, even if it's just to survive an incredible horror.
And let me say one other thing about this movie, too. There is a scene in this that I thought showed what a great director Jon Stewart was, especially for his first time out.
That is one thing I'll say. This does not feel like a first-timer's film. This feels like someone who is well-practiced and understands the medium.
So there's a scene where you see through the eyes of our protagonist,
Muzzir Bahari,
while he's in the prison, but he's thinking back, and he's thinking of all the people on the streets of Iran, and they show these hashtags and then things written for all these people he's seeing on the street, and it's just attached to everybody, like, riding bicycles, that are riding motorcycles, that are down the cars, up through the buildings, like, over the whole street. And they did this great way of showing how Twitter was such an important part of this Iranian revolution. That's, maybe it's not a revolution, but this whole protesting of that election.
If it's not
how important that Twitter was to this, they were able to sum it up in this 30-second scene with a couple of special effects. Like, it was amazing.
In a way that doesn't feel over the top or ham-fisted or...
Yeah.
It's so... You can tell Jon Stewart has what a lot of directors don't, and a lot of first-time directors especially don't, which is an understanding of subtlety and how important, especially when you're making a film about political things and political ideologies and political people, how important subtlety is to make a film that's accessible to anyone and everyone, as opposed to making something that is for one group of people and has no value to anyone outside that group.
And to add to that, there's another scene at the beginning of the movie where he's walking down a street and he's walking by all these store windows, and in each pane of the store window, there's somebody from his past talking about their experience being imprisoned. And it gives you all this backstory to the character and this neat little, you know,
it's such
special effects thing. But the thing is, it doesn't overtake the movie. It would have been so easy to make it a stylized movie and throw this stuff everywhere.
It's a moment within it.
Yeah, these two scenes that I talked about looked flashy, but they're the only two scenes, and they completely serve to further the movie and shorten the movie, because both of those scenes are able to express things and ideas in the movie that would have taken probably 15, 20 minutes to express, that are expressed in this very short segment. I mean, it's just amazing.
There are things you would need a monologue to get this exposition across. And Jon Stewart understands, A, that it's a visual medium, and having just one person talking at you is not the best way to get information across. And B, that there are elegant ways to share this exposition beyond shoehorning it into someone's dialogue, essentially. And to see someone, and you can tell that's the sort of thing that just comes from experience within the business. Most first-time directors are making their first feature film in their late 20s, early 30s, mm-hmm. their first major feature film. Jon Stewart's in his 50s at this point.
Yeah.
And it's his first film, and you can tell that one of the best decisions he made for this film he made years ago, which was to wait and absorb information and to really learn things to make sure that when this time came, when he found the story he knew he needed to tell, he would not be disappointing in his obligations to that story.
See, and that's the interesting thing for me, is that this movie feels like a sixth or seventh effort by a very seasoned director who's in his prime, quite frankly.
Yeah, this feels like a Ridley Scott movie from now, essentially. Like a guy who is...
No,
and what I mean by that is, not so much in terms of the quality, so much as it sure-handed in the way it's presented. It's okay. Not presented by someone who's...
He's definitely capable in every aspect.
Yeah, but what I mean by that when I say it's like a Ridley Scott movie now is it seems like a movie who's made by someone who is not trying things out or throwing things at the wall to see what sticks.
Who knows what's
They are making
work.
Choices because they know what works.
And I would say clearly his experience of The Daily Show has got to lead to that.
Has to be a part
with,
of it.
With building these segments. I'm just surprised at how well in this new medium he's able to do
it's
it. No, I know he's been an actor in a lot of things, like
Death to Smoochie.
Yep, half baked. but this is
movies
clearly
not
on
like this.
Level. Yeah, yeah, movies not like this. But please see this.
It is worth your time.
I believe it's held over through
it
next
is held
week.
Over.
And don't delay. Come see this movie, Rosewater. It's excellent.
Thanks again for joining us on The Thin Men. Special thanks to Lenny Eckhart for coming in and talking with us. Please check out The Boy and Sister Alma, his current project. You can see dates on Facebook or Twitter or Tumblr. You can also check out Rosewater, now playing at the Myrna Loy Center. And that's it for now. We'll see you next week.
Stars are always is washed out by the sun, but we know they're still there.
What can I do for you today?
Well, I am looking for Christmas presents for my family. Just, I really let it go this year. Do you have anything good for me?
Of course, the We Had a Good Life podcast, which you can find on the Not Safer Network.
A podcast? I guess I was thinking more like a Furby, maybe?
Maybe Montucky Skies is more up your alley.
I guess, is that also a podcast? Because again, I'm looking for something a little more tangible.
Podcast? Why, speak no further. We've got Box Office Battle.
You know, I gotta say, I'm beginning to feel like you're not listening to me. Again, looking for gifts like I can put in a box or a bag and wrap them for my friends and family.
Perhaps shooting the show would be more your speed.
You know, work with me, not for me. Let's work as a, let's try to attack this as a team. Again, gifts, family.
Is your family into art?
Sure, yeah.
Well, then the Thin Man podcast would be right up your alley.
All right, do you have something that's not a podcast? Because this is a little frustrating.
Real Roulette isn't a podcast anymore, but we do have the archives available on the Not Safer Network.
I mean, it seems pretty clear at this point you have an agenda. You're not going to sell me the toy robot. You're not going to sell me the beautiful handbag. And you're not going to sell me that cool poncho. What are you going to sell me?
That's debatable. It's a podcast about arguing.
You know, I gotta say, at this point, I feel like I understand arguing. So I'm tempted, but again, not what I'm looking for.
So you're looking for something tangible that you can hold in your hands.
Ideally.
Well, why not the Not Safe for Network podcast, which you can hold in your hands on your iPod or MP3 player?
Sure, that counts.